And excited for this morning and what will be the first of three weeks on our new series called Money Habits. Aren't you glad you came to church when we're talking about money? Yeah, it's good, eh? People love it. I mean, usually I don't get much of an enthusiastic response when we talk about money, but I think it's important. I think it's something we need to talk about and give some thought to, because we want to be here at the Well. We've just come off the Beatitudes and talking about being centered on the person of Jesus, centered in the Word of Jesus, the truths of Jesus, and live lives that are anchored in and centered on the ways of Jesus in the world. Amen. And so, why wouldn't that affect our finances and our lives as we live them? Because the truth is, we all have, whether you're conscious of them or you know whether they're good or whether they're bad, we all have different money habits, right? We have different habits and practices when it comes to money, right? Sometimes they could be good, sometimes they may not be so good. And so we want to spend some time over the next 3 weeks looking at what are the money habits of Jesus? What are those money habits or financial practices that we see throughout the scriptures that would shape and form us as followers, as disciples of Jesus? And so we're going to spend some time talking about that. Today, we're talking about worship and how giving, the practice of generosity, is an act of worship. That worship and giving are intimately linked. This is what we'll be talking about today. Next week, we'll be talking about the practice of community that has economic implications for us. It actually means that there's things about our practices, our money habits, that form and shape and affect us in terms of our community and experience of community. And then the third week, we'll talk about our work and equity and how we earn, and how we would go about those kinds of things, and the habits we would have around those, that they would be shaped. And so through this series, I've been really drawing heavily from this book that I borrowed from Pastor David. Well, I didn't borrow it. He kind of like gave it to me and said, "Hey, Clint, you're really thinking about this series. You really should have a read, have a think about this." And it's been really challenging. So, it's one of those books that, like, if you want to like have a good long hard look in the mirror, it's good, but it's not one you want to recommend too lightly. You know what I'm saying? It's one of those like, oh, this will wreck you. Look out. Practicing the King's Economy. The subtitle says Honoring Jesus in How We Work, Earn, Spend, Save, and Give. By Michael Rhodes and Robbie Holt. Anyway, so this has shaped much of this morning's teaching and also some of the thoughts in here, and also over the next couple of weeks we'll be talking about that as well. But really, I've been thinking about it in terms of, as we get started, thinking about this morning's teaching in light of the Olympics. Who's been watching the Olympics? Man, I've been loving it. Hey, our girls are so into it, and I love how, you know, you get watching the Olympics and you get caught up in all these events that you didn't even know existed a week ago. But now you're an expert in them, right? You know everything about it, and you know what they were doing and how they could do it better, and you know all commenting on all the technique and all that kind of stuff. You go to work and you're chatting with everyone around, you know how that, and oh man, how they over rotated on the entrance, you know, after the diving. Do you see those 14 and 15 year old Chinese girls? Unbelievable. That was incredible, right? And then you see the Kiwi athletes. I mean, that was so good. Thursday night was like a standout night for me. Like, I just spent the whole night on the couch watching the Olympics, and I'm not even ashamed of it. It was amazing. And just watched it all night long. The girls were there. We were like, oh, it was amazing. So good. You see the Kiwi cyclist in the Omnium. That was incredible. Like, pulls it back like in the last 20. Unbelievable. So good. Jump from like fifth or sixth to like silver place. Crazy. Anyways, and then like all these different events, but you start to see, that was the 1500 was on Thursday night as well, the heats of the 1500, the men's 1500 heats, and Nick Willis was there. You know, Nick, you know, what a stud, right? What a gun. He didn't make it through to the final, but still, what a gun, right? Nick Willis in the 1500, and then who's the Kiwi shot putter? Yes. So not Valerie Adams, the guy who placed, you know, from Timaru, right? And anyway, so you look at these two guys and you put them alongside of each other and you go, man, these are both world-class athletes at the top of their games, and yet you start looking at their physique and physiology, they're quite different from each other, eh? You imagine Nick Willis stepping up into the men's shot put competition. The thing might break his arm before he got it off the block, you know? Or you imagine, what's his name, the shot putter, lining up for the men's 1500. That's not going to go well for him either, is it? He's going to end up hurt and injured, and like probably they'll both end up hurt and injured because they've been training for years in very specific training programs that have prepared them for that moment. You know what I mean? And I think when it comes to money habits, we've actually need to be the kind of people, I think actually... Sometimes, let's just put it this way. I think we've actually been trained in a training program that has not prepared us to live and function economically and financially in the ways of Jesus. We've been adopting and following a training program that is very different than what Jesus would have us follow. We've been following a training program that's prepared us for a different event than the one Jesus calls us to enter. Does that make sense? And so that's my hope this morning, is that we'd begin to kind of shed some light on this, reveal a little bit of what's going on here, that we'd increasingly become the kind of people who know what it means to be with Jesus and become like Jesus in who we are as people and do the kinds of things that Jesus would do, and that would shape and have an impact on all of our lives. Because the truth is, when we look at Scripture, we see that actually worship is actually an economic issue. There are financial implications when it comes to worship. We see that evidenced in the very nature of God Himself. From Genesis to Revelation, all the way through the Scriptures, we see over and over and over again, God is portrayed and depicted as a generous God, one who gives of Himself again and again and again, gives of Himself freely. In creation, He created all of this. Well, not for Himself, but for us, right? And then even when God's people kind of strayed and walked away, He gave again a calling to Abraham and Abraham's family and said, hey, I'm going to bless you. I'm going to give even more. And through you, you're going to be a blessing to the ends of the world, right? To all over and over and over again. You know, over through all the way through the Old Testament, in the New Testament, God continues to give nothing more fully than in the person of Jesus Himself, who came and gave up heaven, gave up all His rights and privileges of heaven and became one of us to die in our place, rise again from the dead and leave again so that He could give and send the Holy Spirit who continues with us now. This is the graciousness of God, a generous God. This is who He is. It's His very nature. And so we would expect that if we're going to, like these guys talk about the king's economy, if Jesus is truly King of all, Lord of all, right? If Jesus is King of kings, Lord of lords, and all that kind of stuff, we'd expect that His kingdom would reflect the king. And if the king's generous, we'd expect His kingdom to be generous. And if we as His disciples are increasingly trying to become like King Jesus and live lives that reflect His values, His nature, His ways, then we ought to as well become generous as people, right? You see how it follows all the way through. This act of worship has economic implications all the way through. It should give, the way we live out our generosity should give signals and of our allegiance and where we're committed and who we're committed to and even our dependence upon. Who we're dependent upon is upon God and on God's kingdom. A guy named Kelly Kapich is an author and theologian over in the US. He writes this in his book. He says, all things come from God, are sustained through Him, and will eventually flow back to Him as the ultimate owner of everything. Only by affirming that Yahweh is the God of creation, with everything flowing from Him, through Him, and to Him, can we rightly relate to God. That's kind of the setting or the foundations. And this is why throughout all of human history, we see all the history of the people of God, we see that next to prayer, the giving of something of value is the oldest and most significant form of worship. It's always been practiced by the people of God all the way down through. If our king is generous, then His kingdom will be marked by generosity. And if the king is generous and His design, His intent is for our lives to increasingly reflect His, then we ought to live generous lives as well, right? The trouble is, we can go, yeah, that sounds all good. Heard that before. Been to church for a while, Clint. Thanks. And overlook what the Bible talks about as a corollary to this practice of worship. Because The Bible also kind of warns when it comes to worship. It warns about where we direct our worship. And the biblical term that we need to be cautious of, and we don't like to talk about it in our worlds anymore, is idolatry. And the Bible says, don't worship idols. You know, don't worship idols, worship God. And it's easy to miss the point that, you know, when we read about this, particularly in the Old Testament, and in the Old Testament, one of the most common idols that the people of God got caught up in worshiping was the god of Baal, or Baal, maybe, in the Old Testament over and over again, the god of Baal. And basically, the god of Baal was known as the rider on the clouds. So Baal was known as a fertility god. He was the one who would send the rain, you know, and in an agrarian culture where everyone's like small farmers and whatnot, this was a big deal. The rain would come, it would bless the land. They would see that around the fertility, this would actually help couples have children, which was a sign of blessing and goodness of God on their lives and flourishing and all that kind of stuff. It would be even Baal who was attributed at times of bringing people back to life, raising the dead to life kind of thing. So these were things that people often associated with Baal and so when you're the people of God and this is starting to go on in the nations all around you and getting established, we often think that it'd be crazy for the people of God who have witnessed the power of God at work in all these different ways in their past. We'd think it'd be crazy for them to trade off the God of creation, Almighty, you know, God of the universe, in order to worship some carved wooden idol, right? But that's not actually what they were doing, because they recognized the god of Baal as this fertility god who would bring rains and blessing and flourishing and all that kind of stuff had economic implications for them. So it's not likely that the people of God would just dismiss worship of Yahweh, you know, creator God, altogether. No, it was likely that they continued showing up at church and giving their tithes and, you know, offerings on top of that and praying on occasions, especially around the festivals and the holidays, all that kind of stuff. Usually they just layer on top of that, you know, the odd offering to Baal. Like if Baal is truly the rider on the clouds and you're a farmer, you probably don't want him against you, right? You probably want him to be on good terms with you. You know what I'm saying? So it's like a little added extra insurance policy, right? So we just kind of give a little bit extra to Baal, keep him appeased, make sure we're in, you know. So it was this mixing and mingling that was going on in the people of God. And God says through his prophet Elijah, I'm going to have none of this, no more. And so he sends Elijah to tell Israel. This is what it says in 1 Kings 18, verse 21. It says, stop limping between two different options. Stop limping between two different options. And through Elijah, God declared that Baal couldn't deliver the goods and his people couldn't have it both ways. And we know this because God actually showed up, and we know the big demonstration of God's power on Mount Carmel with 450 prophets of Baal. But actually, God demonstrated it quite intentionally in chapter 17, right before you get to 1 Kings 18. In the chapter before is where we see Elijah actually sent by God out to the Kereth Ravine, which is right in the heart of Baal worshipping territory. All the nations around this area would have all been worshipping Baal. And God's the one who stops up the rain and sends a drought. The drought then sends Elijah, but God continues to provide for Elijah by that dried up stream, by flying in, it's like the original Uber Eats, flying in food by ravens, you know what I mean? Sending in, taking care of Elijah by this ravine. And then he goes on to the town of Zarephath, where God continues to show and demonstrate his power by providing for him and the widow and her son that he's staying with, where the olive oil continues, the flour keeps coming, the bread can continue to be baked, while everyone else around the surrounding nations and in that village were without. Famine, drought going on all around them, but God continued to provide. The son, actually the woman's son, died, and God provided life and bringing him back through Elijah. God did all of this before getting to Mount Carmel in 1 Kings chapter 18. In all of those ways in chapter 17, you see God's demonstrating and saying, it's not Baal. Quit this messing around with both options kind of thing. It's me. I'm the one who provides all things. I am the owner of all. And God, and then we see this goes on over and over and over again. So we see actually through that, I think this sense of worship is an economic issue. It has financial implications. It has issues. It speaks to our money habits. And Jesus knew all about this. When we get to the New Testament, we see he knew all about gods such as Baal. But he knew that in his day, there was maybe something even more insidious, even more subtle, perhaps stronger temptation, which was to replace worship of Baal or wooden carved images with money. Or mammon is often the way that the Bible talks about it, you know. And then we treat money as an idol like we would Baal. And an idol to worship, it gives us an idol to worship as God to get what they wanted. But the truth is, we cannot serve. Just like God said through Elijah, you cannot serve. Quit limping between two options. God says through Jesus himself, you cannot serve both God and money. You see, in Matthew chapter 6, Jesus himself says this. He says, no one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Have you ever thought about that? Let's take Jesus at his word. Let's take this seriously. Jesus is saying that money and the worship and the trust in money as security, as provision, all of that. If we allow that to become like a little insurance policy we add on, what Jesus says is that over time, it won't just be like this, it's all good thing, like worship of Baal on top of worship of Yahweh. Over time, he says, actually, you will learn to hate the one and love the other. You'll learn to depend and serve and be devoted to the one and despise the other. So if money is the other master, Jesus is saying it'd be possible for us to hate him and despise him. That doesn't sound much like the kind of life Jesus calls us to, does it? That's a pretty easy question. I would hope that you'd say, no, Clint, it's not. Right? But this is the challenge, right? This is the challenge of Jesus' teaching. And Jesus knows the significance of this. He knows how important this is. In fact, later in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul actually links greed and money. He says, you know, greed is idolatry. He says, greed is idolatry. And to be greedy is actually to begin worship of other gods. See, idols had always threatened to steal the love and the trust and the service that God deserves from his people, that God demands, you know? And by making this move to aligning greed and idolatry, I think Paul essentially challenges the church, challenges us to recognize we don't have to enter some rival temple to worship some other god in order to engage in idolatry. No, he's helping us see that our greedy hearts can cultivate those idols in our own wallets and in our own bank accounts, right? This is why Jesus over and over and over, so frequently, he warned his followers, he warned his disciples about greed, about money. He warned them about placing your trust in those wrong places because he knew that all of those parables, all of those things, Jesus was pointing in the same direction, saying money wants your worship. Money wants your attention. Money wants all of that. But every bit of ourselves that we give to our stuff, we remove and we take away from our true king, which is why Jesus says you can end up loving one and despising the other. You see it? The Bible also teaches us, in case we're still not clear yet on the danger of idolatry, Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 6, he writes this. He says, people, those who want to get rich, fall into temptation. Fall into a trap, fall into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. Hold on. Do you hear what we're just reading? Is this landing? Are you with me? Do you believe that actually just wanting to get rich can inevitably cause destruction? That's what Paul's saying, I think. Right? Then he goes further. He says in verse 10, he says, for the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people, eager for money, have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. So basically, Paul's saying, love of money destroys your worship. It wounds our worship. It woos us away from faith, and it wells up inside of us all sorts of evils. And just in case you're wondering what kinds of evils Paul might have in mind, James tells us in James chapter 4, he says this, You desire, but do not have, so you kill. You commit murder, kind of evils that can well up inside of us. You covet, but you cannot get what you want, so you quarrel and fight. You do not have because you do not ask God. But when you ask, you do not receive because you ask with wrong motives that you may spend what you get on your pleasures. James says, that's wrong motives. This is stirring up all kinds of evil inside of you. This is soul-destroying stuff. You see how dangerous this is? And because our material possessions and our pursuit of wealth and gain and stability and all that kind of stuff can so easily seduce us into worshiping like gods, they pose, I think, one of the biggest threats to our souls. Doesn't it? One of the biggest things that will hurt us when we worship money, the scriptures tell us, it will hurt us. It will maul us. It will destroy us. It will pierce our souls, is what it says, right? Money becomes this spiritual power that too often uses us rather than us using it. It winds up consuming us and our souls, and it never stops consuming and destroying as it goes. In the end, Psalm 115 says this, when talking about idols, it says, those who make them, idols, will be like them, and so will all who trust in them. Whew. That's pre-Jesus, by the way. That's like Psalms, you know? That's the psalmist saying that. So we said earlier that when we give, we reflect the generosity of God. We reflect the nature of God's kingdom. This is what we're called to. But when we worship the idol of money or mammon, when our lives become oriented primarily towards earning and getting and keeping, and what happens to us is we become deformed. You see it? We're actually training in a different program to the event that God's entered us in, right? And our world is doing this to us all the time. We become deformed. We no longer reflect the image of God, our creator in heaven, the Lord of heaven and earth. But instead, we begin to reflect the nature of mammon, the God of me and mine, the God of money. And we become increasingly committed to a lifestyle of abundance, of possessions, of experiences, a life of leisure and of luxury, right? And such living falls short of the life that Jesus invites us to experience. We think that's the good life, but Jesus says, no, life to the fullest is actually quite different. You're training in the wrong program for the wrong event. In 1860, there was a ship that was sailing from Panama to the U.S. Quite some time ago, and it I don't know what happened, it ran into trouble and it sank, and over 400 people lost their lives as a result of the shipwreck. One of whom was a wealthy businessman who happened to have on the ship with him over 200 pounds of gold. And I was reading about it this week, and they said that, you know, as the ship was going down, he didn't want to lose all of his wealth or risk losing all of his wealth with the ship sinking. And so he started loading himself up with all of his gold, right? Like kind of like strapping it all onto himself. You know what I mean? And before he dives into the sea. That was good thinking, right? We all know what happened. Of course, it dragged him to the bottom and he died along with everyone else. And yes, he lost all of his wealth along with his life, right? And one of the people I was reading this past week said, now as he was sinking, said this, has he got the gold or has the gold got him? And this is just, I think, a vivid picture, a vivid illustration of how so many of us can easily find ourselves drowning in our worship of stuff. The signs are all around us in the world all around, right? In fact, these guys in their book, they talk about how contemporary economists have talked about a condition that where it's shaping us so much so that they don't call us Homo sapiens anymore. These economists talk about us being Homo economicus. Economicus. That's what they say, right? Where instead of our identity being in who we are as human beings, it says this view defines people as being, here's what it says, at their core, solitary individuals whose lives are devoted to increasing pleasure through consuming more material goods and increasing leisure. The formula to achieve this kind of happiness is pretty simple. Get more services, consume more stuff, and work less. That sounds good to us, right? That just reveals we've been training in the wrong program, if that sounds good to us. But it does, right? And obviously this should sound a little bit far-fetched and a bit lopsided. I know. But what if our idolatry is actually reshaping us into this image of Homo economicus, right? What if by investing our love and our trust and our identity and our security in materialism, then we begin to lose our ability to see, value, or pursue just about anything else? What if living in a life that's dominated by Homo economicus, it's given us these training routines that have gotten us into good shape for the Homo economicus event or game, but have left us horribly unprepared at the starting line of a kingdom economy and a life lived in and with Jesus? What if our worship of these gods is actually destroying and shrinking our souls, leaving us empty and in despair? You know, there's actually some evidence to suggest this might be the case. Between 1968 and 2001, there was a study I read, between 1968 and 2001, there was, they said in the Western world, average household incomes per capita, you know, household incomes more than doubled within that time period, 68 till 2001, doubled incomes. And what was interesting is within the same period of time, they noticed that giving decreased, even amongst Christians and in churches, giving decreased. Now, I know I was reading that and I'm like, oh, yeah, those who were maybe back in the 60s and 50s and 60s, yeah, people would have been committed tithers, you know, full 10%, that kind of thing. So maybe it dropped down to 9% or maybe 8%. No. It dropped from 3.1% to 2.6% of the total household incomes. So it was already quite low and it dropped even lower, like half, even though incomes doubled. And this increased income, the evidence shows, hasn't actually made us any happier. That in fact, over the same time, we see mental illness and suicide rates have increased along with our income increases. So how have we become so much wealthier and at the same time, more suicidal and less generous? Well, there's lots of attempts to answer this, but I wonder if Jesus offers a pretty simple explanation. Pretty straightforward answer. I wonder if the New Testament would say greed is idolatry. And that's going to kill you. It's going to destroy your soul. We're designed to find ourselves being fully satisfied and whole and flourishing through a worshiping relationship with the infinite God of the universe. But instead, we've cultivated an infinite desire for finite stuff. You see it? We're deformed. We worship material possessions. We look to them for security and safety. We place our trust in our bank accounts or our KiwiSaver or whatever it might be, investments, you know, and we put our trust there. We cling to them for security, and we're being made in their image rather than Jesus. And it's maybe easy to dismiss, right? And go, yeah, well, that's true for others and especially those rich people. And, you know, like think about all that money that was blown on the race to space. And, you know, like we can easily kind of like extrapolate this out and away from ourselves and dismiss ourselves from being caught up in it. So in case you weren't already feeling uncomfortable, let's get honest with each other. One of our values around here is to be open and honest in how we worship and how we live. And these guys in this book offer a one question test to kind of get a sense of whether or not the idol of materialism is present in our own hearts and in our own lives. One question test. You're not going to like this, by the way. You're not going to like this. But I want us to, this is a challenge for us to be willing to confront the idol within ourselves rather than just push it out and assume it's for everyone else. Are you ready for it? Here, we can put it up, Henry. Imagine you're offered your dream job, the one you've always wanted. You couldn't imagine anything better. Your dream job, but it pays half your current salary. Would you take it? Imagine you're offered absolute dream job. Couldn't imagine anything better, but it only pays half your current salary. Would you take it? See, my guess is That living fully on half of what you currently earn strikes you, as it strikes me, don't get me wrong, with great fear and trembling, right? Maybe you just kind of had a wee shudder in your seat. Like I did too when I first read that. I was like, oh gosh, I don't know. I don't know about that. Like, let's personalize it, right? I see that. That just, it sounds totally and utterly impossible. And that revealed, actually, this idol is present in my life too. You know, I'm right there with you. And I'm one, Jamie and I, we've been tithing most of our lives. We've been giving generously. This is part of who we are. And yet these things still kind of can sneak in and creep in. But here's what this is challenging about is that actually if the average household income 50 years ago was half of what it is today, that think about that. The people 50 years ago lived on half of what we live on today. Could it be that our love of money has led us to believe that the standards of living 50 years ago as normal have become almost impoverished in our mindset today? That the standards of living for our grandparents 50 years ago that we no longer accept that they're even feasible for us today, right? And that those kind of like that research and that study actually does account for inflation, because I know you're all thinking that. You're like, yeah, but Clint, inflation, you know. Can't get off the hook that easily. It accounts for inflation, right? I mean, and not to mention even the 3 billion people in our world today who live on less than $3 a day. This is a reality, right? And so we can easily find ourselves trapped in this earn and work and spend cycle, and then you've spent so much that you need to work even more and earn even more, and you keep angling and looking for ways to pick up some extra hours or earn a little bit more on your side hustle and all that kind of stuff because we've got some new and brilliant way that we want to spend a little bit more in terms of our lives, and that just then we begin to overwork ourselves. Being able to try and afford the ever-increasing kind of lifestyle that we're living into, and we get what we get, we spend up to the point where we feel pressure to just get more, right? And small wonder that actually when you look around our world that consumer debt and credit card debt is like all-time highs as well. You know, we're being formed and recreated in this image of homo economicus, aren't we? It's an idolatry to money. Let's just name it and face it honestly before Jesus. And we let me just also say, like, maybe for you it's not even about keeping up with the Joneses and having a certain lavish lifestyle and all that kind of stuff. It doesn't always have to look that way, but it can look different, like measuring our self-worth against what we earn or what we don't earn, where our egos get boosted when we get a pay raise and we go, oh, that's, you know, or maybe the other way, actually, when we see that actually I feel, or you feel like you're not being paid what you're worth, and you see, you interpret that as evidence of your worthlessness. You see, that's getting into identity kind of stuff right there. And I think that's realizing how often this can have that shaping effect on our lives. And the truth is, this kind of thinking can come even in disguise, like masked up, looking like stewardship, can't it? It can come into us and tricks us into thinking that God would honestly prefer that we make sure we're all shored up against every possible financial disaster. We got all those things kind of hemmed up before we open up our wallets in generosity. But that's actually good stewardship. That's what God would have us do. I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure if we take Jesus at his word. The Old Testament, before we even get to Jesus, the Old Testament mandated a 10% tithe. The first 10% of everything that came in was returned to God. And then there was all kinds of offerings and gifts on top of that, right? And Jesus ups the ante. He says, yeah, tithing's a good place to start. Grow in the grace of giving is what the New Testament teaches. Don't stop at 10%, but grow in the grace of giving. And we see that over and over and over again. In the New Testament, the earliest Christians, they were living under occupied rulers, under really heavy, excessive taxation, right? That was taking all their income. And nevertheless, and they were exploited in different ways, nevertheless, they were liquidating assets and selling property and things in order to share their homes and their wealth with one another and provide for everything that was needed. Paul celebrated the Macedonians for giving so lavishly and generously out of their poverty. You know, so it's not about amounts and whatnot. And yet today in Western Christianity, it's like the richest people ever to walk the face of the planet give away less than 3% of our highest average incomes. earned in all of human history. That's pretty sobering, eh? How are we doing, church? Are we ready for some good news? Because the good news is that Jesus confronts this idol in our lives, but doesn't leave us there. He actually gives us a way out. He gives us a way out. By the power of his Spirit, Jesus renew our hearts and rescues us from this dehumanizing idolatry by restoring us as worshipers of Jesus. See, when we worship the idol of materialism, we become increasingly less human. But thanks be to God that when we behold the glory of our King Jesus, Paul writes that we are being transformed into his image with ever-increasing glory. And by worshiping God with every part of our being and with all of the saints throughout human history, this is the ultimate solution to idolatry in our lives. This is our way out. This transformation from greed to generosity, it may not happen overnight. It may not happen in an instant. You know, it doesn't just happen in a single moment. Even after we've been renewed, like I said earlier, even after we've been renewed, we experience the Holy Spirit coming, all this kind of stuff, with salvation in Jesus' name, we can still lapse and fall back into old habits and old patterns of thinking if we don't keep this before us. Right? We got to keep this in mind. But thank goodness that when Jesus gives us this practical step, this act of obedience, that when we enter into it, he adds his grace and liberates us from the idolatry of money. What's this practice, you might ask? Just before Jesus warns us about serving both God and money, he tells us in John chapter 6, 19 through 21. He says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Where your heart is, there your treasure will be. Would be another way of rephrasing it, right? And it's true. And we often read that and we go, oh, that's really good. You know, that's like, you know, I see a few doctors in the room this morning, a couple of nurses, you know. This is a good diagnostic tool, right? This is helpful, Jesus says. You want to gauge the condition of your heart when it comes to generosity and giving? Take a look at your bank statement. And what the things, where your money's going, that shows you your priorities, that shows you the things that you value, that shows you, right? I mean, it shows you all that kind of stuff. Like, that's a good diagnostic tool. I actually think there's a better way to interpret this passage. That I think that's true, right? I think that's true. And that's often how this text gets interpreted. I think there's a better way that's closer to what Jesus had in mind, that's less about viewing this just as an evaluation or diagnostic tool. This isn't just a thermometer to gauge the temperature of our hearts. It's actually more like a thermostat to set the temperature of our hearts when it comes to generosity and giving. That Jesus actually says, give first. Invest first. Be generous. Practice this act. I'll add my grace, and then you'll see the temperature and the condition of your heart change in response to that. This is what Jesus is saying. I think he's saying, actually, it's more like a thermostat, right? Like this is the prescription to heal the disease of idolatry and materialism in our lives. Is that if we practice this, and according to Jesus, when we invest in the kingdom, our hearts will follow our investments. They'll be drawn there. And we'll pray more fervently for those things. We'll be much more invested in what's happening with those things, right? Our hearts will be not in earthly treasure, where we'll be feeling worried and caught up in comparison and just needing a little bit more. You know, we end up worshiping money, and that just takes up all this power over our lives. But when we invest instead in the kingdom of God, our hearts will follow that. And giving will break the cycle of momentum that materialism can have in our lives. I don't know about you, but like, have you ever, I remember when I was a young fella, like quite young, Some of you know that I started up a BMX gang, and I got a BMX bike for my I think I was like 7 or 8, and it was cool. And the initiation rite for anyone who wanted to be in my BMX gang was to ride along the we had these like big open footpaths where I lived in Maryborough in Australia, before the footpath and whatnot is just grass, you know, and there's no fences, so you just ride all the way down all the neighbors' houses, like this big long grassy strip. You get out, you had to go on like full tilt and then jam your foot in and flip yourself over the handlebars. Like, it was just a vicious thing. I don't know if anyone actually did it other than myself, but That was kind of the initiation rite. But that's kind of like what I'm getting at. That's the kind of jolt I think that we need in our lives to break that momentum and that cycle of this idol of materialism in our lives, right? We've got to be able to jam something into the wheel of our BMX that'll throw us off and help us to reset and get going in a different way, right? The giving, it does that. And giving, generosity, and these practices, they help us cast down the idol of money from the throne of our hearts. See, when we give, we release our grip on money and our hearts are freed up to worship God. Our hands are freed up to work with God and for God in God's kingdom. When we give, the Spirit inhabits our generosity and works to reshape us in the image of our generous God. And through giving, God changes our hearts. He transforms our lives. He sets us free. And we begin to experience that we're free from materialism and all of its toxic, disordering power in our lives. And we're freed up for lives that honor King Jesus and seek first his kingdom. This is the way it works, right? Becoming generous worshipers of Jesus is good because generosity is good for us. It is. This isn't just something we do for others. No, there's all this evidence to prove, you know, and the verdict among those who engage in this concrete practice, they all affirm and come back saying, you know what? Jesus was right when he said, it is more blessed to give than it is to receive. Absolutely. You ask some of the most generous people you know, and they'll all tell you the same thing. Giving is one of the greatest joys and blessings in their life. You ever heard that before? I mean, I've experienced it myself. And so the truth is, we all know giving and generosity can get corrupted, and there can be ways that we can enter into this practice or this training program that aren't necessarily God-honoring. There are ways that we can do it that are kind of more self-promotional, that make us look good to others because, oh, look what I gave and I helped this person and I did, right? There are ways that we can do that are self-justifying, that are self-preserving, and all of these ways that we can give that just don't reflect the character and nature of God and his kingdom. And so I think that it's important for us to know. I mean, even the Pharisees knew that, and Jesus told them off about that in the beginning of Matthew chapter 6. But so what kind of giving actually does glorify God and shapes our hearts? And if we were to think about the training program, what would be some of those key elements if we were to start giving and living a generous life? I want to give four that are taken straight from this book, Practicing the King's Economy. I'm hoping you'll find them helpful. The first is that giving shapes our hearts when our gifts are given to God. When our gifts are given to God. That's when we direct our giving and generosity towards God, recognizing that, after all, he owns everything anyways. All we have is from him and is through him and is actually for him. So it's giving. When you're giving to God, it's not actually like giving. It's more like returning, right? It's almost like I'm returning this like a library book, you know? I'm just returning this to God from whom it all came anyways. And so we should be aiming our generosity towards God. This helps prevent us against aiming our generosity at looking good in the eyes of other people. You see it? You know, so this is a good safeguard. We recognize all giving in this sense is true worship, where we place him as the first priority and the direction and the target of our giving. It gives back to God what he's given to us. This serves as an act of love, as an act of trust, as an act of devotion and service, really, to the owner of all things anyway. And I love that, you know, we've talked about giving and generosity and tithing and all these things in the past around here. And some of you, maybe a few years ago, will remember we actually did a 90-day trust test. And the reason we did that was we just realized there were a bunch of people who, you know, would give on occasion, but hadn't actually established a consistent, steady practice and habit of giving in their lives. And so we used this 90-day period of time where we committed together, especially providing just an on-ramp, really, for anyone who hadn't initiated the practice of tithing to start and to give it a go for 90 days. And then at the end of those 90 days, we took some time to just reflect back on and see how has God shown up in those last 90 days. And consistently across the board, people experienced more blessing and goodness of God, more sense of his presence in their lives, more experience of his grace and provision in their lives. And the truth is, you know, we taught in that, you know, that actually, you know, if you give your first 10% to God, that actually living on, you get the blessing of God on the remaining 90%. And 90% with the blessing of God goes further than 100% without the blessing of God. Remember that? This is what we talked about. And most people I know that I've talked to who took that initial trust test have only continued. And it didn't last just 90 days. They're still going years later. And this has been true for Jamie and I. Like in our lives, we were tithers before we met, and we've only continued. And we've continued to grow. So every year, we actually give more than 10% each year. So I'm not preaching out of anything we don't actually practice. Like I said, it's not like we've got this down pat. No, this is something we still are needing to learn and grow. Like I said, reading this book has been freshly confronting me in some really healthy ways. And God's doing a good work inside of us. And we want to be the kind of people who do this. Secondly, giving shapes our hearts when our gifts reflect the heart of our King. Giving shapes our hearts when our gifts reflect the heart of our King. See, giving must conform to the heart of our King if it's going to form our hearts towards His kingdom, essentially, right? So we got to ask, what is it that God's heart is aimed at? What is it that He wants these gifts to be contributing to? And over and over and over again throughout the scriptures, I think there's two main things that God speaks that show up. First is to the poor and the marginalized. Our gifts ought to be aimed there. This is near to God's heart. He has a special place in His heart for the poor and the marginalized in our world. This is over and over again. We see it, you know, the Old Testament, the New Testament, this call to share with the poor is one of the most central themes throughout the scriptures, over and over again. It's primary message. I mean, Jesus even described His message, the good news, the gospel message, as being good news for the poor when He first kind of began His public ministry in Luke chapter 4. The second place, though, is to gospel mission, shall we call it. And again, we see throughout the scriptures that the giving and generosity towards proclaiming the good news of the gospel in places where it hasn't been heard before. Planting churches, missionary work, that kind of, you know, mission, gospel mission type stuff, again and again and again, supporting the work of the ministry of God over and over again. We see this all the way through. Paul's efforts in the New Testament to collect offerings and celebrating those who gave was so that it might support the ministry of God. Jesus' ministry himself was supported by wealthy people who donated and gave, particularly a couple of wealthy women who gave and supported the ministry of Jesus. This evangelization and planting of churches for the sake of those who are without hope and without the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ. These are the two places that consistently throughout the scriptures we see God's gifts being directed. And if we were to practice our generosity, that would shape our hearts in the right kind of way. This would be the right kind of giving. You see what I'm saying? This would be the right kind of training program to enter into. That we give in ways that reflect God's kingdom. This is two ways. And let me just be clear. We as a church practice this in our church finances. You know that? We give about 15% of everything that comes in goes out beyond the walls of our church. Doesn't pay for staff or buildings or ministry stuff here. It goes out in local and global mission, support of our denomination and church planting and things like that. 15%. And these are two primary filters that we run when we consider mission partnerships. Is this going to be helping and ministering and serving the poor and marginalized in our world and advancing gospel mission in our world? These are two primary filters we run in our church. So this is, again, congruent with who we are as a church collectively and the way in which we want to increasingly practice and be generous people, that it would shape us in this way. Is that all right? Is that good? Number three, giving shapes our hearts when it builds community. When it builds community. We'll be talking a lot more about this one next week, so I encourage you to come along there. But basically, if you don't have to read very far into the story of the early church in Acts before you come across the end of Acts chapter 2, and then again in the end of Acts chapter 4, where it describes this community of people who are together constantly, sharing everything that they had, selling possessions to provide for the needs of others. It was this giving and generosity that was building up and strengthening of community. And it was a way in which everyone who came got to participate, got to play, got to contribute and offer something. There was this sense in, even by giving to the poor and the marginalized, created a sense of family with them and a place of belonging, because it was this interchange between giving and strengthening of connection between the giver and receiver. And so we see this again and again and again throughout the way in which our giving can shape in good ways and in healthy ways to reflect the heart of God, is to create community rather than undermine it. Fourthly, giving shapes our hearts when it follows the way of the cross. Giving shapes our hearts when it follows the way of the cross. What do we mean by that? Well, Paul writing in 2 Corinthians has this one of the most powerful passages on generosity where he basically calls the Corinthians to give like Jesus gave, who is, he says, though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that through his poverty you might become rich. That's pretty challenging, right? We're often told we need to be willing and ready to suffer for Jesus, lay down our lives for him and for his cause. And I think what we've forgotten in the West is we often assume that to mean, you know, withstanding physical, emotional, verbal persecution, right? We talk about blessed are the persecuted. But we often like leave our wallets out of the mix. You know, oftentimes people say, have you ever heard the joke around church? Like when people get baptized, the first two things they'll take off is their wallet and their watch. You know, like, God, you can have all of me except for my time and my money, you know? You can have everything else, right? And it's like, and I think in the West, oftentimes we're like, yeah, Jesus, I'm willing to suffer you. I'm willing to pay the price, except for when it comes to finances. You know what I'm talking about? We're willing to enter into the world suffering. But I think, actually, this is an invitation for us to declare the lordship of Jesus in all of our lives, including our wallets, where we're actually willing to enter into the suffering in our world and the needs in our world by taking some of the economic burdens of the poorest of the poor on our own backs and helping shoulder that load. If we want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection, then costly generosity will be one of the ways that we share in the fellowship of his sufferings, right? Sacrificial generosity. Ron Sider wrote a book called Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger. And in that book, he laid out this idea, this concept of graduated tithe, that you don't actually hit 10% and stop, that the more your income increases, the more your giving percentage increases. And you just keep growing in the grace of giving. And in fact, I met a guy, I was telling the 9 o'clock services, a guy I know in the US who, incredibly wealthy individual, but he had capped his lifestyle at such a frugal level that the whole 90-10 percentage of get tithe 10%, live on 90%, he inverted it. He lived on 10% of his income and gave 90% away. And he lived very simple, frugal life, right? I mean, incredible. And so as we come to wind down, it wasn't just Ron Sider's idea and talking about this in this book. It actually kind of comes further back, I think, with Jesus himself. But C.S. Lewis, who loves C.S. Lewis? What a champ. Love that guy. You may not love him as much after this quote, but here's what he wrote on this subject. He says, "I do not believe one can settle how much we ought to give. I'm afraid the only safe rule is to give more than we can spare." Oof. In other words, if our expenditure on comforts, luxuries, amusements, etc., is up to the same standard common among those with the same income as our own, we are probably giving away too little. If our charities, or that's our giving, do not at all pinch or hamper us, I should say they're too small. There ought to be things we should like to do and cannot do, not because we don't have the money for it, he says, but because our giving, our generosity, our charitable expenditure excludes them. We're so invested in giving to the kingdom of heaven, God's plans in the world, that actually there's things that we would like to do that we just can't do because we're already committed. We're already invested financially elsewhere, right? That's cross-shaped giving. And C.S. Lewis tells us what Jesus tells us. It ought to affect our lifestyles. That's normal Christian practice. That's the difference of the training program of Jesus against the training program of our world. You hear it? That's very different, right? If there aren't many things that, you know, I'd like to do that I can't do because I'm so invested in God's work, then maybe I'm not giving away more than I can spare. And if that's true of me, then maybe I cannot fully claim to have entered fully into God's economy and Jesus' kingdom movement of generosity. Truth is, our generosity won't fully shape our hearts unless it represents a real investment of our treasure into the kingdom of heaven. But I think, if we practice these four ways of giving and generosity, when our giving is actually truly given to God,
first and foremost, prioritized above everything else, when it's given in line with the heart of God and the things that He cares about, when it's fostering and building up the community of God. And then I believe that if given in this sacrificial way of God, in the way in which He has given to us, then I think it has the power to condition us and shape us differently, shape our hearts towards the God who laid down Himself for us, impoverished Himself for us, He who became poor for our sakes, right? And then if we do that, the scriptures tell us, we'll begin to understand, we'll begin to experience the good life, the full life, the blessed life that God truly intends for us, where we'll be able to say with full confidence, because we've experienced that, we've lived it with Jesus, hey, it's far better to give than it is to receive. And we'll know the blessing of when our treasure is in heaven and our hearts are shaped in that direction. We know the full blessing, fuller measure of God at work in and around our lives. And that's my hope and my prayer for us and for our church as we journey on through this series. So we'll be back next week with part two, looking at community a little more intentionally and some of the economic impacts of that.
Thank you for listening to the sermon. We trust that the Holy Spirit was speaking to you through it. If you would like prayer or to connect with The Well, we would love to hear from you.